Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. I'm Racing Post editor Tom Kerr. It's Monday, December 12th, and this is The Front Page. It's been a freezing cold week, and while most of us have been shivering beneath duvets and blankets, our race courses have been trussed up in fleeces. Little good it has done, mostly, unfortunately. But while there hasn't been much action taking place on the track, there's been plenty to discuss off it. And joining me in the studio to discuss it today is John Harding. Welcome, John.
Morning.
Since your last appearance on this, of course, you have become an award-winning journalist, or multiple award-winning journalist, Specialist Writer of the Year. Congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
How long did the celebrations go on for?
I sort of reached a crossroads of this is going until the early hours or I'm going to be at home with a pizza at a reasonable time. And I took the latter, luckily.
Good on you. A consummate professional, as exemplified by the fact you've made it in battling wind, snow, hail, traffic disruption, and the rest of it. Not something we can say for our two remote callers, but we're very pleased to have Ireland editor Richard Forrestal and betting editor Keith Melrose on the line today. Welcome to you both. Okay, let's get cracking. We're going to dive straight in, John, with your story of the week, which is about honeysuckle. Take us away.
Yeah, so this is a story I really wasn't expecting to read and has come from slightly left field, and it's Henry de Bromhead basically opening up the possibility of Honeysuckle dual champion hurdle winner not running in the champion hurdle and instead going for the mare's hurdle, which is slightly baffling. His quote is to the effect of, "My job is to find her a race she can win." Obviously, Constitution Hill is her chief opposition after impressing so much last time, and Honeysuckle didn't impress last time, so I can understand the sort of, from a competitive angle, it's not going to be easy for her to win a champion hurdle, but at the same time, my heart says this is the clash we've all been waiting for. It's the one we've been building up. We want to see Constitution Hill and Honeysuckle do it at Cheltenham. I understand why Henry de Bromhead has to keep his options open, because that is his job, to find winnable races, and he doesn't have to commit to a race so far out, but if you're bidding for a third champion hurdle in a row, an amazing clash, it would be good for the sport if she went down that line. So one to watch, I think. Big story.
Massive story. I mean, there's been a lot of talk recently about ducking and diving and trainers, owners opting for easier races, avoiding big challenges. But this is surely the ultimate example of it, where you've got a double champion hurdle winner, a winner of 12 grade ones as well. You know, I mean, if she's going to duck a challenge, and okay, the challenger is potentially a generational talent, then surely the sport's in a bit of trouble there.
Well, it doesn't bode well at all, does it? And we've, you know, it's the equivalent of a sort of Altior or something dodging one, a newcomer in the championship. I just don't really see it. She's good enough to win a champion hurdle still. It's not a case of forms dipped so considerably that you understand they might want to go out on a win and they've lost the unbeaten record, so they just want to sign off nicely. And I don't really buy that. I think she's still an exceptional racehorse, and we have been building up this clash. They have engaged with it as well. The owners, Kenny Alexander, has been very much looking forward. Let's take on Constitution Hill. Let's see what he's got. It would be a huge, huge disappointment from a sporting perspective and from a fan perspective if she doesn't take on Constitution Hill. Worth noting, she still might. Obviously, this is just, we're keeping our options open and everything else. A little bit of, I don't know if it's sort of Sir Alex Ferguson mind games or something like that, but I'm praying that she does take him on, and I'm praying she bounces back next time, wins our race nicely, Constitution Hill at the festival, and that would be a race for the ages.
The race we've all been waiting for. Richard, I want to bring you in here. Do you have sympathy with Henry de Bromhead identifying the mayor's hurdle as a potential route for Honeysuckle, or are you in the camp that this would be completely the wrong way to go?
Oh, it'd be completely the wrong way to go. Tom, look, anyone who's familiar with my opinions and writings on these kind of things over the past number of years will know how much I object to the way the programme book has been bloated, and that's epitomised by the Cheltenham Festival going to 4 days and being diluted to the extent that it has already. The mayor's hurdle came about because of the expansion of the program there and the addition of the extra day. And look at what it's doing now. This is the kind of thing we're dealing with. You should be at the Cheltenham Festival, which is the pinnacle week of our sport. You should be compelling horses to take each other on, and the best against the best to find out who is the king of the lot, if you like, or the queen of the lot, as it were. And that's why even races like the Ryanair Chase, they're consolation races, if you like, for me, because you have, on the one hand, the 2 mile champion chase and you have the Gold Cup. One is about the fastest horses in the land. The other is about the strongest stayers, the highest quality strong stayers. You stick in the Ryanair chase and all of a sudden you've got a compromise. You know, the ones who aren't fast enough to win a champion chase or not strong enough stayers to win a Gold Cup, they settle into the mid-rank race of the three, if you like. This is the same thing. We've got a mare's hurdle there. It's another option for high-class mares. It shouldn't be there, in my opinion, at all. It's why we will probably never have a Dawn Run again, because why would you risk a high-class mare going over fences and running them in the Gold Cup when you have, number one, the mare's hurdle along the way, and now you also have the mare's chase? It's a travesty, if you ask me, that the option is there. If it wasn't there, Henry de Bromwell wouldn't be considering it. By the time March comes around, she could have won 4 Irish champion hurdles. I'd fancy her to win her 4th one when she goes back there in February. You know, I don't think there was an awful lot wrong with her performance the other day. She ran into a couple of good horses who were both ridden very cannily to kind of pin her on the line, if you like. It's an absolute... It'd be a disaster if it comes to it. I would hope, to be honest, that Kenny Alexander and Henry would maybe look at the bigger picture in time to come and come down on the sporting side of running her in the champion hurdle against Constitution Hill, all being well if they both get there in one piece.
Yeah, I hope so as well, Richard. And I think if you look at Cheltenham day one prices, what you're saying about the dilution of the programme at the festival becomes very starkly clear, because right now, in mid-December, we have on the opening day of Cheltenham a 5-4 favourite of the Supreme, a 5-4 favourite of the Arkle, although it's odds on with at least one bookmaker, a 1-3 favourite of the Champion Hurdle, and a 2-1 favourite now of the Mayor's Hurdle. And needless to say, Honeysuckle did go that route, she'd be a lot shorter. We also have a 3-1 favourite of the National Hunt Chase, for what it's worth. I mean, Richard, that is not screaming elite sport, is it?
No, exactly. Too many options, and they can spread out their high-profile, high-quality horses to the races that they think have the best chance of winning, and they'll avoid the big clashes, and this is the perfect example of that. I know it mightn't happen, hopefully it won't, but there's a lot of water to cross under the bridge between now and next March. Constitution Hill mightn't even get there, Honeysuckle mightn't even get their horses, and we know when you turn the screw at this level, they can break. And look, the travesty of it would be, for example, if you picture the half an hour around the champion hurdle time with the mayor's hurdle following it, and say, by some misfortune, Constitution Hill fell at the first in the champion hurdle. Where is Honeysuckle at that time if they go down this road? She's walking around the pre-parade ring waiting to be saddled before the mayor's hurdle, and the race would probably be hers for the taking in Constitution Hill's absence at that stage. We don't want to see that happening.
Keith, I want to bring you in quickly on this one as well. If you're looking at the champion hurdle from a betting perspective, you know, how do you assess it? If you were responsible for plotting Honeysuckle's target, would you be willing and confident that she could give Constitution Hill a race?
No, she won't. Nothing can give Constitution Hill a race. He's the best horse we've seen for years. But I have said, I can't have a go at Henry de Bromhead for what he's done. He's playing the game that's in front of him. The problem is the game's changed and we've not adjusted to it, really. You know, as it's all been touched upon, there's fewer good horses, there's more good races, and what good horses there are concentrated in fewer hands. That describes the situation you're seeing there with 4 short price favourites on day one of the Cheltenham Festival. It'll be more by the time, I have no doubt about that. And, you know, it's good for one type of punter, but for a lot of us, those of us who like the sort of challenge of it and want to see, you know, are more interested from a sporting perspective than from a roll-up perspective, that's not for us. That's not as good a day. I mean, Honeysuckle going to the Champion Hurdle, for me, it's almost immaterial now because nothing's beating Constitution Hill. It'd have been great to see her do it. I'd like to have seen her do it because she had the reputation behind her. But I think in hindsight, the day she got beaten Hatton's Grace, that was a moment where we could go, she'll never race Constitution Hill.
I fear you could be right. But John, just to wrap this up again, you know, part of Constitution Hill becoming the giant that we think he could be, is surely that he's got to face the best around. And if the sport is structured in such a way that those challenges simply don't happen because the the rung down from the very best will just go for easier targets, then what you've got there is not a functioning sport that's going to reach out and engage people who are maybe not completely dyed-in-the-wool racing fans.
No, you're right. Something's not right. And I always think on the flat, for instance, racing is a test of the thoroughbred for their career as a stallion. And it's the same in jumps. You know, that essentially we're testing these horses every time we race them, and you want them to be tested against the best horses, therefore setting that bar and finding out how good the horse you own is relative to the other horses in the population. Mm. If Constitution Hill is running against horses running for second and third at huge prices and not taking on a Honeysuckle and not taking on these bigger names, it's just bad. It's bad for the owner, it's bad for the sport, and it's difficult to sell a sport when those storylines aren't there, because there's a lot of kind of niche things in racing and nuances and technicalities that appeal to the sort of hardened fan. But if you're selling, if I was to sell the first day of the Cheltenham Festival to someone who's never been, you know, I would say, the champion, if I was to sell the Champion Hurdle to somebody who's never been, I would say this is one really good, exceptional young horse who might be one of the best we've seen versus a two-time winner. That's a much easier sell,
yeah,
isn't it? Those are the storylines we want to sell.
You don't get Usain Bolt versus the 50th best sprinter in the world at the Olympics.
They don't dodge the Olympics because Usain Bolt's there.
Exactly. Well, this story will run and run. I'm sure we will return to it. Let's hope Honeysuckle and Constitution Hill do meet each other at Cheltenham in March. We're going to move on to our second story. And Richard, I'm going to come to you for this one. What have you got for us?
Yeah, it's in relation to Ronan McNally. This is a case, I suppose, we've been waiting on for a couple of years at this stage. And the IHRB published their findings last week in relation to it. It's a very elaborate case. Conspiracy, basically, is a word that's used. And it's kind of far-reaching. And I suppose maybe if I just summarise some of the aspects of it, it started really with Dariel Deal's wins about 2 years ago now, just over 2 years ago, at Navan in September. He won off a hurdle mark of 84. He nearly fell at first, and he still won pulling a train, as it were. That prompted the stewards on the day to refer it to the IHRB, and he had the distinction of being referred for a second time when he won on the flat at Limerick subsequently. That was off a low mark as well, I think 45. So that was the start of it. The horse went up and won, I think, six on the spin, including a couple on the flat. He ended up winning the Grade 2 Moscow Flyer Hurdle at Punchestown. He improved over 4 stone, alarmingly. So, I mean, you know, to think any horse could progress to that level from a rating of 84 in the first instance, you know, it's a big improvement. It then kind of, if you remember, I actually did a column last year. There were a number of gambles being landed at the time, and the one that prompted the column was a Call Me Freddie gamble at Cork, Sam Curlinghurst. Again, it was referred, and ultimately there was no case to answer in relation to that one. But at the same time, there had recently been a gamble involving one of David Dunn's horses, All Class. Again, no previous evidence of any significant ability, and she turned up at Navan then in March of last year off the mark 48, and bolted up, landed a big gamble, and continued to show improved form then after that. No sooner had the ink dried on that column than Full Noise won for David Dunn. Again, similar gamble, no previous form, and landed a hefty punch in good fashion. Now, at that time, I actually did a column, and between looking at all these cases, I managed to join a few dots, and you could see the links, as it were, between maybe David Dunn and Ronan McNally. And sure enough, that is what was published then last week in this finding. David Dunn was ultimately found to be training horses for Ronan McNally. That ownership was concealed. They were both found guilty of concealing the ownership. And then there was Kieran Fennessy brought into it as well. Kieran Fennessy is someone that Ronan McNally has done a lot of dealings with over the years. He sourced a lot of his good horses from him, including the Real Deal and the Jam Man and so on. And he was brought into it on the basis of inside information being passed on to him from McNally. And while Dunn, on the one hand, has been found guilty of misleading the stewards and concealing ownership. Kieran Fennessy, on the other hand, it looks a little bit more serious for him as well as McNally, because he has ultimately been found to have brought the sport into disrepute in relation to the passing on of inside information. It seems to his father, Liam, and his brother, Aaron, who aren't licensed. So, you know, what sort of sanctions they might face, I don't know. I'd be focusing here on the licensed individuals, Rona McNally. I mean, there's a list then in relation to McNally, failing to school horse appropriately for stalls, failing to report issues relating to runs, you know, issues that may have impacted a run. I think there's about 8 listed there, 6 for the real deal and a couple for the jam man. He admitted not kind of revealing issues relating to a horse's health that arose from the Irish Equine Centre. I suspect this is relating to aspergillus. Again, one of the aspects of this, we weren't given a lot of details or evidence. We were just told the findings. But I suspect that's in relation to the aspergillus, which, by the looks of it, the horses were being run maybe when they were suffering from this, and he didn't relay that to the IHRB. What else? He was found guilty, obviously, of horses failing to ensure horses ran on their merits. He rode the jam man in one of those instances at Navan. And ultimately, he was found to have conspired with Kieran Fennessy to engage in corrupt or fraudulent practice. One other interesting aspect among many others was that there were findings here retrospectively in relation to the running and riding. So McNally was found to have been guilty of the non-triers rule in relation to the jam man, and so was Owen O'Brien, the amateur rider. Now, that's unusual because we haven't had cases where they've gone back and looked at cases and found them to have been guilty retrospectively. So that's another interesting angle to it. Look, it's a long and exhaustive charge sheet. It's the kind of thing we'd want a little bit more detail on, because although they've given us this raft of findings, we don't know what they have used to come to these conclusions, really. The BHA is the betting integrity partner for the IHRB. We don't know if we have betting evidence of horses being backed or laid by the Fennessys, for example. We don't know an awful lot of the intricate detail of it. But at the moment, looking at what the findings have suggested and knowing the scope of a referral panel's powers, Ronan McNally is most likely looking at losing his license, and he could face significant fines as well. So it's a bizarre sort of case. It's unfortunate. I think the conversation over the last week or so has turned to, they're hitting the small man, and I can relate to that. I can see why people would feel that when you look at maybe what goes on in the sport more generally. We all know, I suppose, how you have to use the system to some extent when we acknowledge that. Maybe Mr. McNally is guilty of abusing the system a little bit. You know, that could be one interpretation of it. It was a fairly blatant case in relation to the real deal, to go over 4 stone. And I thought one of the interesting phrases they used here in convicting him was, and if you just let me find it, the evidence in relation to, I'll read the whole line. It is alleged that Mr. McNally failed to ensure that his horses ran on their merits, and or that he used the racecourse as a training ground by running horses insufficiently schooled in order to obtain handicap marks not reflective of their ability in advance of their handicap run. And this is the interesting bit. The evidence is to be found in a pattern of running of his horses in a number of races already referred to in the report above. So there's various races that are highlighted there, and we're retrospectively being told that he was using the race course as a schooling ground ultimately, or the horses were running and not being allowed to run on their merits. So that's all very interesting, that they're going back retrospectively and marking the steward's homework, if you like. It's not the sort of thing that's been done before, and it's a fairly damning case from Ronan McNally's point of view. As maybe I didn't allude to, the sanctions hearing won't be till January, whenever they can get everyone convened. at some stage in January we'll learn a bit more about it. But it's, as I say, a fairly damning finding.
Yeah, lots to unpack here, Richard. But first of all, you said in January they'll have this sort of sentencing. You mentioned he's likely to lose his license, but what level of potential punishment might there be here? And indeed, we should add before that McNally has indicated he will appeal the judgment.
Yeah. And there were certain points on this. He admitted, you know, in relation to not furnishing them with certain information in relation to the Irish Equivalent Centre findings. Again, whatever that may be, as I say, I suspect it's aspergillus. Look, they could. I believe the referrals panel could fine them up to $100,000 for each guilty finding, if you like. You know, I think that's probably unlikely. But I suspect he's going to be looking at, you know, unless his appeal is successful. If he does appeal, I'm not aware that has happened yet. You know, he's going to be looking at a hefty five-figure fine, surely. And you'd imagine he's going to lose his license for a period of time. I wouldn't care to speculate on it, but. You know, Charles Burns lost his license for 6 months for, you know, ultimately not having a horse watched constantly at Tramore when the Viking Horde case blew up. You know, there was no finding in relation to Charles Burns' betting activity or anything like it, or conspiring to, you know, dupe the betting public, if you like, in relation to the horse's handicap mark or anything. And he got 6 months for that. So I don't know. It's going to be very interesting, but you'd imagine if they follow through on what they're suggesting here, and if they have all the corroborating evidence, which you'd imagine they have, it's unusual that they haven't published it. And I thought it was interesting last week that Ronan McNally said he wasn't passing inside information on. He said the Fennessy said he wasn't passing inside information on. And he said there was no evidence to suggest he was passing inside information on. So in a situation like that, you just wonder why they haven't published whatever corroborating evidence they have. But if they have this evidence and if it all stacks up, then you'd imagine the sanction is going to be significant.
And I'm sure we'll return to this story when that evidence is published. Richard, one last question. The committee said that these actions had caused serious damage to the interests of horse racing in Ireland. How serious is the damage?
It's not great, but there is an element here. Like, we were talking about the Mayor's Hurdle and the Ryanair case and all this, and how it's the system as much as anything that's causing the problem, and you can't blame Henry de Bromhead for wanting to run in the race. He thinks he's got the best chance of winning. And we're looking here at a system issue as well. If you're a trainer in Ireland and you're trying to compete with Willie Mullins and Maiden Hurdles and Gordon Elliott and Maiden Hurdles, you're on a hiding to nothing, because if, you know, invariably you're not going to beat them. And if you get too close, you're going to ruin your handicap mark. So the smaller operators have to try and work within that system. And we know this is the way racing is done for years and years. You know, you look at Sir Mark Prescott, who's renowned for keeping a little bit up his sleeve and delivering on the horses when it's expected, if you like. So this is an extreme example of that. And I think what McNally is guilty of here, as much as anything, is going a bit too far in the sense that he's left a lot of people with red faces in the case of the Real Deal in particular. So how much damage has it done to Irish racing and its perception? Look, there's obviously reputation damage when something like this comes up. But at the same time, I think people realise that there is, for want of a better phrase, there's a game here that's being played, and it's being played on a daily basis. And if we want to do something about it, then that has to be addressed. And there's no good shooting fish in a barrel, small people like Ronan McNally, who ultimately can't really fight back. You know, there's plenty bigger, stronger sharks in the ocean who could be targeted and probably are targeted. So, as I say, if we want to address this properly, it's the kind of thing that has to be done in a holistic manner, if you like. And horses have to maybe not be judged on one good run, or there has to be some sort of a handicapping amnesty to give the smaller operators a chance to be competitive. Because if they show their hands in full with horses that are going to be, you know, getting on the coattails of David Jennings mentioned Fasal Vega at the weekend, then they're not going to have a functioning business model. It's as simple as that. So Yeah, it has brought a bit of negative publicity. There's absolutely no doubt about it, but it's a broader issue than just this one.
I think this is one where if you begin pulling on the thread, it will go places you don't necessarily expect. It's a fascinating story. Thanks very much, Richard. We'll move on to the third story, and this is the one I'm going to nominate. And John, this one's following up a three-part series we ran in the paper and online for subscribers last week, basically looking at betting shops, their past, what they're like today, and where the future might lie. They were really interesting pieces, sort of visiting the gamut of different betting shops out there, from sort of old school places, still have that community feel, to some of the modern ones, which can sometimes be, you know, quite soulless, to be frank. And then finally visiting a modern future betting shop with lots of digital screens, really nice sort of distressed wood furniture, got that sort of a Scandi warehouse IKEA vibe sort of thing. Yeah, exactly. Really good reads, first of all. But what I thought was fascinating was just some of the data and insights in there about where betting shops are and where they're going. And two sort of key ones I thought I'd bring up here. You know, the first was just the scale of the decline in betting shops over the last few years, because we've had two massive shocks to the system. They had FOBTs being, fixed odds betting terminals being restricted from £100 to £2 a spin in 2019. And then in 2020, of course, the pandemic, which shut down retail for several weeks and created a very difficult operating environment. And the net cost of that basically is that from 8,320 betting shops in 2019, we are now at 6,219. So that's a fall of 25%. And obviously all 2,100 of those betting shops were paying media rights, they were contributing to the levy. So there's a direct knock-on impact on racing's revenues. And the second was just about how the turnover sort of take has changed in shops, and how racing, which is still the dominant business in shops, has been in sort of slow decline over the years, and now has fallen from about 55% of takings to less than 50% now, with football being the main beneficiary. But then online, the picture being very different, where racing and football are basically on a par, basically. And that really sort of indicates to me, I think, both the sort of demographics of the racing audience and potentially the demographic challenge facing retail betting shops. Where do you think betting shops lie? Do you think betting shops have a long-term future? If we're sort of pacing the streets of London in 2045, will there be betting shops?
Oh, it's a big question. I mean, there's a direction of travel, which is south, unfortunately. But I think retail, surprisingly, I know it's a noticeable drop over the years, but I think it's probably even surprised a few people how resilient it has been in a way. I know that sounds a little bit unorthodox given the decline in the numbers.
Well, people did predict a higher decline.
Yeah, but FOBTs, they have proved fairly resilient. I remember speaking to Stuart Kenny, formerly of Paddy Power, who was saying there will always be retail, there'll always be a place for them. I'm not convinced long term, but in the immediate future that all the right things are being done to modernise them and make them an interesting and accessible place to go. And as those pieces quite nicely showed, that there is still a feeling of community in there. It's difficult. I think perhaps at times they suffer through association. I think certainly among my peers, the perception is if you're going into a betting shop, you maybe have an unhealthy relationship with gambling, and or you're going in there for the fixed odds and the machines rather than necessarily placing a bet on the horses. I think that's unfair. But I think there's certainly their image is something that they'll be very conscious of if they're to have a long-term future.
And fixed odds betting terminals obviously played a big role in that. And in some ways, these sort of future betting shops trying to present a very different image.
And as well with, I remember doing kind of charting the rise of 888, and they were very interested in buying William Hill's retail sort of operation and getting involved with taking over those shops. So if an operator like that sees a future in them, then it can't be as bad as perhaps was originally billed. There's clearly some sort of juice to be taken from them still, but whether in the, you know, many years down the line they're still for part of the high street. I don't know.
Keith, how do you see the future of betting shops unfolding?
I think it depends to a large extent on societal perceptions of gambling generally, because the main draw of a betting shop today is still the social element of it. I've been to one of those shops in the future. I went to Vicar Lane in Leeds recently, and it's quite an impressive setup, actually. That shop's set up like a little bit like a Warren, so there's lots of little areas where customers can have that social element as well as having all the what's available to them. But that's all available online, and what retail has in terms of betting is that social element is being there. You know, I went to a shoe shop immediately straight after being in that shop, and I could tell you the difference between retail and online in terms of buying shoes, but I couldn't tell you the only difference when it comes to going to betting shops over doing so online. It's not about information. It's not about holding the product in your hand. It's about being in a social environment, and that has to persist for betting shops to be a particularly viable retail outlet over the longer term. So that's not a rosy thing to say, because we know the way that gambling is being treated generally in society these days. You know, I think, and it's because it's grown too fast. You know, it's grown from being behind the beaded curtain to becoming this absolute giant in the space of 10-15 years. So I'm not especially hopeful. I see a lot of good work being done, and the fact that these big firms are investing so heavily in the retail space tells me they think there's life to be breathed into the retail space. I'm not certain it'll be in their control, the long-term future of retail betting.
I think as well, one of the things that they struggle with the new shops is the limitations on what you can offer in a betting shop, because we all know the sort of the trope of getting a cup of instant coffee, but that is literally pretty much all they're allowed to do. And if you want to create a sort of cafe vibe, but you can't sell pastries and sandwiches, then, you know, you've got a little bit of a challenge. And that's definitely something where, you know, if the government, which is not generally minded to do anything to alleviate the pressure on bookmakers, was minded to make that retail sector a little bit more robust, I think that could actually have quite a big impact.
Well, yeah, then you've got PMU cafes, haven't you? And you know they're a very successful enterprise in France. Yeah, exactly. It's well, obviously, there's a lot more government vested interest in making sure the PMU's takings are really high. But this is a similar point to what I was making, really, in the sense that a lot of these things that would make retail an attractive environment is going to have to be legislative. And at the moment, you know, the sort of media and societal portrayal of gambling is not in a favourable place to grease the wheels to make that happen. So that's why I think it's potentially unlikely. I agree that that's the way things would go to make retail betting secure its long-term future. I struggle to see it. I wouldn't be backing it evens for sure.
Richard, just quickly, the Irish perspective, how are betting shops faring over the water?
Yeah, no, it's held up quite well, similar to there. I mean, it's held up reasonably well in the greater scheme of things. And you look at the betting ring, we talk about it similarly. And you look at our own industry newspapers and what sort of future any of these things have. But they continue to, you know, they're more resilient than we kind of feel there might be. But the one thing I thought was interesting in relation to this is whether at some stage there'll be a push back against online because of the affordability checks and whatnot that are coming in, and whether that will be a boon for shops, you know, and that there'll be a return of cash. Because when you see the obstacles that people are facing with these affordability checks, you just wonder if it's going to work in the favour of retail, that people will be trying to avoid a lot of the hassle and just go and have their bet in cash.
And there's something to be said in terms of keeping an eye on what you're spending on gambling and that as well. It's something that several of our tipsters sort of recommend as well. Put your bets on in cash. It's easier to keep track of them. Thanks so much, guys. We're going to move on to the final story. Keith, we're coming to you, and you've got another big talking point for us.
Well, yeah, it's become a talking point in the last week, hasn't it? Even though the story's existed since July. It's the whip review and how that has shaped how in the last week jockeys have essentially broken rank to talk about it. Finally, the whip being moved into striking horses only in the backhand position, and how the sanctions will involve disqualification and the most serious breaches. Now, obviously that came out, and I was at the time surprised at how little furore it caused when the consultation was first revealed. But in the last week, it turns out that the jockeys have all broken the dam at once, have come out and spoken in depth about their opposition to these new rules, which will come into force for jump jockeys a month before the Cheltenham Festival. So, you know, timing-wise, I can definitely see the issue here. Now, the interesting part of this story is obviously the jockeys breaking ranks, which creates a couple of things. Firstly, is as Jonas has actually done himself, he's talked about the PGA and all this. It looks like senior jockeys are at loggerheads with their representative body on this, basically from the outside. And the PGA need to speak pretty quickly from the time of recording to try and put that to bed, because it's starting to look quite bad for them. But it also talks about the direction of travel for the whip generally. Now, there's a letter in, I think it was Sunday's Racing Post, from my old boss, Jeff Greetham, who talked about how if your desire was to deal with perception in the sport, your first move would have been to ban raising the whip above shoulder height. Moving the whip to the backhand position does look a lot more of a drastic step, and potentially looks like it's on the way to phasing out the whip as well. So we've got these two strands of it competing. The most immediate story for this week is how, for, it's not often you see the PGA completely at loggerheads with their representatives. You know, we can go back to the sort of the bad old days, really, of the Brian A. Frost case, where the PGA's stance, unfortunately, to align with a lot of the senior jockeys, whereas in this instance, it doesn't seem to have been the case. And it's interesting because obviously we had some senior jockeys in Tom Scudamore and PJ McDonald on that panel. Now, what this actually means for what happens when these things come into force, we had the banning of the, we've got a little recent precedent on this, actually. They banned the whip for encouragement in Sweden after using it. It had been restricted to, I think, 3 strikes until in January this year. They brought in some new rules, and within 2 weeks of them being in place, there was threat of strike action from jockeys. Now, the situation is very different here. That incident in Sweden was to do with a very specific wording of the rules, which was necessitated by the way that Swedish and Scandinavian jockeys had learnt to ride around heavily restricted use of the whip. And there was a wording to the rules that ended up being interpreted poorly by stewards and ended up with all these threats of strike action. And they eventually didn't backtrack, but they had to rewrite the rules hastily. And as far as I know, it's not actually been corrected yet. So this is how explosive it could potentially get if jockeys choose to go a certain way once the new rules come into force. But you expect they'll need to be singing from the same sheet as the PGA by that point if anything like that's to happen.
Yeah, the PGA, I think it'd be more accurate to say just kind of not really present in this conversation, which is quite unusual. Richard,
Tom, you say that, but I mean, we can assume at the moment the fact they have been silent is sort of taken as an assumption that because they were involved in a consultation, that they're endorsing the consultation. Is that not a reasonable thing
I think it's a reasonable assumption. They weren't. There were two jockeys who were represented on the whip steering group, Tom Scudamore and PJ McDonald, and the PGA were consulted as well, but. Again, I think the absence of commentary from them is a slightly unusual one, especially now when you see so many jockeys coming out and raising concerns principally about this move to ban the forehand whip. Richard, you're a former jockey. Talk us through the differences between a forehand and backhand whip strike.
The forehand and backhand, the backhand position is presented as being less forceful, which is fair enough. I wouldn't challenge that. What I would say is that the backhand position for most jockeys, and if you can see me here, I think if I go like this and I bring my stick down here, it's coming down a lot shorter on the horse than if I do it in the forehand position. I can bring it further back much easier. So they presented this at the time as being, a way forward. And it is to do with the flick of a wrist, if you like, rather than a more forceful forearm position. But I don't believe that it's going to help the situation at all, because you want to hit the horse when you're hitting it behind the rib cage on the rump, on the horse's rear end, where there's a big mass of flesh. Whereas this is going to shorten the strike and it's going to bring it down much more regularly on the rib cage, where there's no flesh, very little flesh, as you know, and it's going to create a lot more problems. And I, I'm surprised it's taken the jockeys this long. I'd echo Ruby Walsh on this, because I did a column in July about this, and I made this point that, you know, this doesn't make sense. This idea that the backhand position is going to create fewer problems than the forehand position, it just didn't stack up. You know, because there is much less flesh and meat above the rib cage, and because you're more likely to come down short on the rib cage, it's going to create more issues. So I just don't really get it. I can see some of the, the thinking that led them here, that it's more of a wrist action and it will be less forceful. But I still don't know how they ended up agreeing on it, having consulted with the jockeys, because as you say, Tom Scudamore and PJ McDonald were involved.
I've got a Tom Scudamore quote here, and I don't want to sort of single out Tom Scud, but I think it's a relevant one, because he says, using the whip in the backhand position, the natural arc means that it more frequently lands in the right place with the appropriate amount of force. So, you know, clearly, although it seems that there's a very large number of jockeys who agree with your take, initially, at least, as part of the steering review group, Tom Scudamore was sort of saying this would encourage the right kind of whip use.
Yeah, I just don't understand it. I don't see how Tom kind of came off to signing off on that view. But maybe that's his opinion. But again, you would have thought he was speaking on behalf of the jockeys as a whole. But to me, it didn't make sense then. And you can see now to the vast majority of the riders, it doesn't appear to make sense at this stage. The frustration with this, and again, you'll be familiar with my views on this, Tom. I mean, if we accept, and I believe it is accepted, that the whip, a foam padded whip used correctly, in the correct place without excessive force, without excessive frequency, is not a welfare issue, then we shouldn't be going down this road at all. Now, if we're going down this road anyway, it just seems to be a case of addressing the optics of a situation rather than the substance of it, which, you know, is this a welfare issue? I believe it's not, and I believe the BHA will tell you it's not. So why we have gone down this road at all, I really don't know.
John, the other controversy here is around the timing of these changes.
Yeah.
The point has been made, I think quite fairly, that if you're bringing in a major change to the whip rules with significant increased bands, and most importantly, perhaps of all, this change to technique, doing it a month before the biggest festival in your sport, when the eyes of the nation and the sporting world are on you like never before, perhaps not the wisest move.
No, I don't think so. And timing is the key word in many senses with this situation, with the jockeys speaking out. Firstly, yes, they've had many months, but the implementation period was only relatively recently announced, sort of last month. So they have had a few weeks of just having conversations with the stewards and learning that they would have been banned many more times than is sensible if it's your livelihood. So I do believe that it has perhaps dawned on the jockeys in a big way. Obviously, they've known about it and would have had their own concerns, but I sense the gravity of the change has hit them, and the issue with the timing has hit them, most importantly. Why would you not introduce it for jump jockeys before a sort of quieter spell of the season? You know, could we have jump jockeys using it in the summer, not to just push summer racing as a secondary thing, but it seems like a logical time rather than before the biggest week of your season, in theory, for many of these jockeys. It just seems sort of poorly thought out, and there are going to be people who, like Richard, are concerned by why we've gone down this route. I think it was well-intentioned. I think optics are more important than perhaps they're often given credit for, as long as you set out that that's what specifically what you're doing. But I just think this is, so far, is creating more problems than it's solving. The optics of jockeys refusing to ride is far worse than them having a slightly ineffective whip action. And the PJA, as I wrote in today's paper, they may be having conversations on the side. You know, they may be talking to these senior jockeys. Perhaps they're even driving it. I'm not sure. But publicly, at least, they have not come out and issued an update to, we're receptive and we're willing to take these changes on. and they need to, because there is essentially an open rebellion among their jockeys at the moment. They might be allied behind the scenes, but that's no good from the outside. They need to say, stand up and say, right, this is what our senior jockeys think. We might have said this before, but this is our stance as of today. Let's open up a constructive dialogue, because we do not want to get to that bedding in period and that implementation period for jump jockeys and it be bans galore, chaos, jockeys unhappy, because that is a terrible look for a project that was essentially designed to improve the optics.
The other thing to note, of course, is this is the first controversy involving the PGA since Paul Struthers left. We've got new leadership at the PGA now, so this is an interesting test for the new leadership.
Yeah, very much so. And I think there's one other point I just have a worry about with these new WIP rules, and it concerns disqualification. And the fact that if someone goes, I think it's four strikes over the limit, they will not be disqualified in the day. The result will stand for betting purposes. And at a later point, a sort of review panel will determine whether they're disqualified. But of course, everyone can count. So if you see a jockey go way over in a major race, you know, we could be stood there after the Gold Cup, hailing Appleutard, but knowing that there's a very good probability that the horse is going to be thrown out a few days later. I see why they've done that for betting reasons, but that to me feels like a recipe for a complete fiasco.
No, you're absolutely right. And the problem is that disqualification is such a big word and has so many ramifications, because it's jockeys, it's owners, it's trainers, it's everybody else, betting purposes, media, it's so many different people will, if the disqualification takes place, be impacted. So they're trying to tiptoe around it in a way that doesn't penalise people too badly or immediately. And I just think it's... clarity is so important on these things. And if a horse is being disqualified, it just go make it immediate if that's what you think. And then it can be perhaps appealed at a later date, rather than, like you say, having the winner, having the winning quotes, having the write-up in the paper, and then a few weeks later, oh, wait a minute, we have a new winner, give them a call. It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
Can I come in there, Tom? Who does that work for? Right? Because you have...
It's betting only. They've done it for betting reasons, because the bookies said it would be a complete disaster if we have horses being thrown out for whip offences. Punters will be up in arms. So they've come to this compromise. But I think it completely invalidates the sort of sporting element of it.
Yeah, but what about the people who back second horse?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Who know they're going to the result is going to be overturned in a week's time, and they've done their money. So I don't see how it works for anyone. It's just one of the most farcical things I've ever read. So you've got the winning connections picking up their trophy, standing on the stand, getting their picture with the trophy. The horse has been hit five times more. So they know they're going to lose the race in a week's time. I mean, what sort of a look is going to be on their faces for those pictures?
And what are we doing? What does ITV Racing do? You know, we sort of go, well, Appleutard has won the Gold Cup, but... kind of not, though, as well.
I just don't see how it works for anyone. It's absolutely bizarre that they thought this was a good idea.
Yeah, I this one feels like... I mean, we all know the whip is such a naughty subject. I've no doubt that everyone involved in this whip review had good intentions, but it feels like one which is going to cause some problems whenever it is rolled out, if it is rolled out on the current timetable. Gentlemen, we better wrap it up there. There's been some fantastic talking points today, and it's a hard one to determine which is the biggest. But John, I'm going to have to go with Honeysuckle, because simply Honeysuckle versus Constitution Hill was supposed to be the clash of the titans around which the entire season was built around. And the idea it might not happen is just so disappointing. But it also speaks to, you know, some of the big issues affecting the sport. You know, this ducking and diving, the ability of trainers and owners to avoid tough races, and the sort of expansion of the fixture list, which has facilitated that. So well done. Great story. Award-winning story right there. Okay, so that's a wrap for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. It only remains for me to say, if you haven't already, do download the new app. It is absolutely packed with everything a racing fan needs, from great content, tipping, live racing, incredible race cards, and lots more besides. And please do like, subscribe, and share the Racing Post YouTube account. Thank you again for joining us. We'll be back again next week. I've been Tom Kerr. Thanks for tuning in.